great or that with the problem that you're facing when it comes to the relationship between the United States, Russia, China, even in the Middle East. We know that behind all of these discussions, political discussions, we need some expertise behind the scene helping these politicians to figure out what's going on. We know that how important it is and how you are involved when it comes to Russia. In your opinion, today, how much real expertise on Russia exists in the West?
Well, the experts on Russia are very few and far between. In some ways, it's people who have been around for a while who can talk out of experience, knowing not only Russian language, which I suggest is essential, but something about Russian history, Russian sociology, Russian economics, the whole thing, okay? Now, we have a bunch of folks who pretend to be Russian experts and really aren't. They've been trained mostly in English at places like Harvard and Yale and Stanford, and they've been given a steady diet of Russophobia. It's very, very sad to see because, as you noted, we are headed into a more major confrontation with Russia. It could be a military confrontation, and the lack of knowledge on the part of the Americans, and frankly, the brainwashing that they have been put through, especially within the last 5 years or so with respect to in respect to Russiagate and Russia hacking and the DNC and all that stuff. So I thought maybe it'd be a good place to start to talk about one of the main suspects here. Her name is Fiona Hill. And before I forget, I should mention that she was the National Intelligence Officer for Russia. What does that mean? That means right under the Director of Central Intelligence or the Director of the CIA, she's the one that runs Russian analysis and, to an extent, covert action against the Russians. So she's a big deal. Now, what did she write right before the invasion of Ukraine by Putin and his forces? You know, this is really important because, oh, there it is. All right. Now, this is a New York Times article. The title is Putin Has the U.S. Right Where He Wants It, right? The date is January 24, 2022, which happens to be exactly 1 month before the real war in Ukraine started with the advance of Russian troops into the Donbass. Now, what does she say? Well, Putin has the U.S. right where it wants it. This time, Putin's aim is bigger than closing NATO's open door to Ukraine. In other words, it's a bigger game than simply preventing Ukraine from becoming part of NATO, you know, a red line for Russia. What it means is he wants to evict the United States from Europe. As he might put it, says Fiona Hill, goodbye, America. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. Now, that's the way this article goes, okay? Now, what's my point? Well, there was a very, very imaginative graphic artist that set this thing up. And there is Putin saying goodbye. Goodbye, America. Get out of Europe. We're going to take over all of Europe. And he has the last five presidents, the last five presidents there, just kind of walking away out of Europe, okay? 1 month before the war in Ukraine. Okay, now let's look at those guys. Let's go, the oldest one would be Clinton here. Okay, what'd he do? Well, he reneged on the solemn promise made by James Baker, Secretary of State under George H.W. Bush, not to move NATO 1 inch to the east of what was then East Germany. He reneged on that and started building up NATO with what used to be Soviet satellite countries in Eastern Europe. So that was a no-no, and he knew it, but he got away with it because Russia was so weak. Russia had just fallen apart. It used to be the Soviet Union. It had fallen apart, okay? Now, that was Clinton. Who's next? George W. Bush. Well, what did he do? Well, he did lots of things, but the worst, in my view, with respect to relations with Russia, is that he said, I'm going to get out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. And he did. He exited that treaty in 2002. That was signed and sealed in 1972. I was there. I was part of all that. It was guaranteeing stability for 30 years, okay? So that's what George W. Bush did. When the Russians asked him, why are you doing this? They said, none of your damn business, okay? George W. Bush, who's next? Oh, yeah, you got Obama. What did he do? He constructed, egged on, and exploited so-called Russiagate, Russian interference in the 2016 election, long before there was any evidence that this happened. When I say long before there was any evidence, actually, there was no evidence before or since. What do you do? Back in October 2016, they said, we have to make sure that people know that the Russians are trying to help Donald Trump. And so let's say that the Russians hacked into those very, very damaging to Hillary Clinton emails, and that they gave them to WikiLeaks. And so the Russians are trying to hurt Hillary and help Donald Trump. That was October 7th. Did he have any evidence? No. Did the FBI have any evidence? Not only did the FBI have no evidence, but they weren't even looking at it. They hired this satellite firm called CrowdStrike. And most of you probably know by now that when CrowdStrike was put under oath in December of 2017, their chief, Sean Henry, confessed there was no technical evidence that the Russians were responsible for hacking those damaging emails from the DNC, Democratic National Committee, or that anybody hacked them. Nobody hacked them. There was none of the technical evidence one would surely see had it been a hack. It was a copy onto a thumb drive, put in some pocket, put on a plane, and gotten to wherever WikiLeaks processed it. Did the WikiLeaks disclosures hurt Hillary Clinton? I imagine they did. I mean, they showed chapter and verse as to how she and the Democratic National Committee had stolen the nomination from Bernie Sanders. I mean, it was right there for her to see. But that was what Obama was helping Hillary win, okay? Now, unfortunately, Obama didn't succeed, right? And so he covered his rear end on his way out. And 2 days before he left, he said, you know, it's kind of an anomaly, but we have no evidence as to how those hacks, or maybe they were leaks, got to WikiLeaks. No evidence? Well, why did you kick out 35 Russian diplomats? So that's Obama. Okay, well, I could go on some more with Obama. So who's that? Oh, yeah, that fellow Trump. What did he do? Well, he was accused of cozying up to Putin, being in Putin's pocket, right? Okay. Well, he was nothing of the sort. Matter of fact, he bent over backwards to show how tough he was vis-a-vis Russia. And I guess the thing that comes first to my mind is that there was a treaty. There was a treaty when Ronald Reagan thought that the Russians were serious about destroying a whole class of medium-range and shorter-range ballistic missiles in Europe. The Russians had, the Soviets had SS-20s. We had Pershing 2s. Gorbachev suggested to Reagan, let's get rid of them. We don't need them. We have these intercontinental ballistic missiles, for God's sake. That at least gives us 30 minutes warning from launch to target. Why do we want just 10 minutes? They got rid of them, okay? The day, the date was 1987. What did Trump do? Well, excuse me just for a second. I'm going to have to sneeze. No, I don't. What Trump did was get out of the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Ballistic Missile Treaty. That was signed in 87. He got out of it in 2019. 32 years this time. When the Russians asked him, why are you doing this? He said, none of your damn business. See how tough I am against the Russians? Okay, that's Trump. Oh, Biden, my God. Somebody told Biden that, we are the exceptional, the indispensable country in the world, and we should act that way, not only to the Russians, but to the Chinese, right? And so what he did was tell his minions to embarrass the Chinese, speak down to them in Anchorage when they dutifully traveled all the way to Anchorage, first couple of months of Biden's reign. And then he got up and he said, now, we are told that the Chinese want to be the supreme power in the world. They want to dominate everything, not only economically, but politically, strategically. Quote, that's not going to happen on my watch, end quote. So that set the tone for the Chinese. And we'll talk about the Chinese later. With respect to the Russians, he was equally bad. He couldn't believe, he couldn't believe that the Russians were really concerned about security arrangements in Europe, that the Russians felt a little bit dissed because of what Bill Clinton and his immediate successors had done, and they were worried. And the red line for Russia was, don't even try to get Ukraine into NATO. And so what did Fiona Hill and Biden tried to do? They tried to get Ukraine into NATO. That was a red line. Now, just to refresh one short memory, the fellow who's the head of CIA now, Bill Burns, was our ambassador to Moscow. And he was called in on the 1st of February, 2008, and read the Riot Act by none other than Sergei Lavrov, foreign minister then and now. And he said, Mr. Burns, do you know what Nyet means? Burns said, I think I do. Well, Nyet means Nyet. You try to get Ukraine into NATO, that's a red line for us. What we will have to do is to cope with what will inevitably be a civil war. We will have to decide whether we want to intervene or not. And we don't want this. So tell your people, which was Condoleezza Rice at the time, tell her, we don't want this, okay? So no means no. And Burns played it straight. That's February 1st, 2008. Now, of course, these days, and starting with what the Russians did in February 2022, unprovoked, illegal, mass invasion. Well, it was whether it's illegal or not, I'm not a lawyer. There is a Article 52 in the United Nations that may apply, but unprovoked? Well, no one knows better than Bill Burns. It was provoked. Bottom line here, you got a CIA director who's a cog in the wheel of the machine that wants to do in Russia. That's the only way the Russians can read this. So that was part of it. And what else did? Well, Biden just reacted by sending more and more armaments and so forth to Ukraine, even though, and I'll say just once again, that his predecessor, Obama, had warned, the last thing you want to do, okay, you got this guy, the last thing I want to do is to give the Ukrainians the idea that they could prevail against a much more powerful Russia. So Biden did it anyway. Why? I don't know why. Because of megalomania or exceptional or whatever it is. He and his minions did that. More recently, we have very good evidence that NATO was involved in planning an invasion by Ukraine into Russia proper, right? Into the Kursk Oblast of Russia. We have very good evidence of Western armaments were used. There may be even some Western soldiers, sheep dipped, as they say, out of uniform or in Ukrainian uniforms. So there is a limit to what Putin will patiently wait on and kind of observe. I don't know where that limit is, but he's under increasing pressure now. I don't think that he'll be mousetrapped or provoked into doing something he doesn't want to do, okay? So let's say he's got 80% support in Russia, which what the polls show, okay? And what people who have been there say, okay? Well, that could cut either way. He's got massive support to do anything he wants, okay? There's a lot of pressure. Hey, we've been invaded by the West again, including German panzers, huh? German tanks, okay? So let's set these guys straight. The other side of it, of course, is that Putin is very perspicacious. He's not going to do anything that he doesn't want to do. It all depends on what he wants to do. He has support for either. Yeah, there's more pressure now, but he can face that down. I don't know exactly what he's going to do, but he's probably going to do more than he has so far, bombing more and destroying more of Ukraine, moving a little faster down in the Donbass. But we're wandering a little bit off this. So that's with Biden. And of course, with Biden, you have Fiona Hill publishes this thing a month before the invasion of Ukraine. And a very curious thing happened. A couple months later, as most of your viewers know, the Ukrainian negotiators and the Russian negotiators in Istanbul agreed on a ceasefire, agreed that Ukraine would no longer seek membership in NATO. Other things, where there were lots of military things, how much armaments and so forth could be held on either side. They agreed to defer things like Crimea, which were too thorny. But there was agreement, and we have that attested to by the Ukrainian negotiators who have spilled the beans since. Okay, what happened? Well, Boris Johnson arrived in Ukraine, in Kyiv, on the, I think it was the 8th of April, 2022, and put the kibosh on the whole deal on behalf of the U.S., on behalf of the U.K. So guess what? Fiona Hill learned about that. My God, you know, she was writing a foreign affairs article, which, sorry, I had the title here, was just as blatant as Putin has the U.S. right where he wants it. Putin's not going to stop. Well, he did stop. And she didn't change any of her text, except she did note that, well, there's this report that Putin had agreed. You know, I mean, she puts that paragraph in there, but does she say Putin's going to stop? No, he's not going to stop, even though, friends, let's face it, even though he stopped. Okay, and that wasn't enough for the West, because the West wasn't about Ukraine. It was about weakening Russia, and none other than our defense secretary admitted to that. So you don't have to interpret these things. All you have to do is get the information. That's what I'm talking about here. You need the information. And what piqued me off on this was a fellow named Don Hank, whom I don't know. All I know is that he blogs. Some of his blogs are really interesting. And he recounted his experience a couple of decades ago trying to get a master's degree in Russian studies or just in the Russian language. And he went to Harvard and Yale and everyone else, and he couldn't find any graduate program that would have courses in Russian, because he had learned Russian. They want to use it, right? And I said to myself, my God, is that how far we have descended in Russian study? You can't have a graduate program while the courses are taught in Russian? And yeah, that was his bottom line. And so I said to myself, wow, you know, in my day, when I was studying in the 60s, studying Russia at Fordham, we had a graduate course. I had an MA from Fordham as well. And well taught in Russian. Sometimes we had a native Russian instructors or professor. One was from Oxford, if memory serves. His name was Zikulin. I remember him very, very, very well. He taught the whole thing in Russian. If you didn't know Russian, well, you couldn't really go to the course, but there were 30, 40 of us that were fluent in Russian and that really profited from hearing this guy in his native tongue. My God, what's happened since then? I don't think they teach Russian in many schools anymore. They used to teach them in high schools, but no longer, as far as I could see. And here's a little vignette. The professors we had at Fordham, a lot of them were out of Russia. They left, you know, at various points, sometimes even after the war. And there was one, a dear man who was a professor in Russian, at Russia, in the Soviet Union. And his name was Malodetsky, Professor Malodetsky. And he couldn't really master English real well. So he taught in Russian mostly, but every now and then when he had a wider audience, you know, he had one speech that he made, one lesson, having to do with the women in the Soviet Union, how they were treated. So he was a sociologist, basically. Huh? And he also started that. I heard it three times. He said, "Today, allow me characterize you Soviet women's. Women's. Now, I grant you, women, it's hard for women. It was so funny. And people would laugh. But he'd go on and he'd try to, in his best English, to teach the course. The point being, well, you know, these people have he was in Leningrad during the siege. He wrote a book, Osada Leningrada, The Siege of Leningrad. It was only available in Russian. He could get anybody to translate it, but we read it, you know. Well, I won't go into the poignancy of that. So all this stuff kind of had a little flashback to me. I said, well, if these people don't know the Russian language, if all they know is what people like Fiona Hill were taught at Harvard by Russophobes like Richard Pipes, okay? That's all they know. Well, small wonder that they easily susceptible to this kind of Russophobic propaganda. Another thing comes to mind here. I had a sort of debate with one of the up-and-coming Russian experts. His name is Matt Duss, D-U-S-S, I think. And I was invited on to Amy Goodman's program for the first time in about 7 years. Why? Well, because we differed on whether Russiagate was real. She had these pseudo-experts talking chapter and verse about how the Russians hacked and all that stuff. It was really quite embarrassing. She knew that I could refute that, so she never had. But all of a sudden, about 2 years ago, she said, Matt Duss, you and Matt with Duss, well, he's out of the University of Washington, right? Now, they used to have a really good Russian program. I can only assume they don't anymore. I won't go into detail, but look it up on Democracy Now. Duss and McGovern talking about Ukraine. And it became so obvious to me what was going on here that I said to Amy, I'm going to sing a little song if you give me a pause. And so I said, you've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to hate. All the people your parents fear, you've got to be carefully taught. That's out of a musical way back when, South Pacific. But you have to be taught to hate the Russians. And I haven't been invited back to maybe I shouldn't sing songs in a program. But yeah, there it is. He was taught to fear and hate the Russians. And he was off base completely on Ukraine. And you look at it, it's 2 years old, look it up. Okay. Now, so what do the people who have been so wrong about Russia and people who just as soon get involved in a firefight with Russia, what do they fear? I'll tell you who they fear. Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter and the rest of us who have some expertise in Russian studies, have some experience in Russia and, for my point, in the Soviet Union. It's Scott's point, too. So that's what they really fear. And when Scott says, look, there's no way the West, NATO, the US, can win a war in Ukraine? Well, he must be in Putin's pocket, right? Give me a break. No, he's just stating the fact. As a matter of fact, as I said before, he's repeating what Obama said. There's no way the Ukrainians can prevail over a much stronger Russia right on their border. So these things are consequential. The Russiagate thing, as I said on your program before, has been thoroughly exposed. But as recently as 2 days ago, you have four-star general Jack Keane, who also went to Fordham, by the way, Fordham Business School, didn't study Russian, obviously. He was 5 years after me. I don't remember him, but I know they went to Fordham. Okay. Well, he was the guy that's saying now, 2 days ago, the Russia attacked into the Democratic National Committee in 2016. We have to get them. They're going to do it again. They're going to do it. They did try it again. It's all built on a bunch of lies, okay? Now, Keane is the person that gets a lot of exposure on Fox News, okay, Fox Business News, I guess. And who is he? Well, he's the guy that when George W. Bush was about to lose in Iraq, and it became really painfully, so painfully true that even Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, was going wobbly. And right before that by-election there in 2006, you're saying, now maybe we ought to change our... So Bush said, my God, this is terrible. Who will we get to replace Rumsfeld? And he found this fellow that used to work for me and later became head of the CIA because he was a real Russophobe, and then head of the Defense Department because W. Bush called him into his place there in Texas and said, Bobby, we need somebody to take Defense Secretary Rumsfeld's place. We need to do something because it's not going well, but we need to have a little surge, like another 20,000 troops shown in there and go into Baghdad there and clean it out. And Gates says, so what are you telling me this for? Well, we'd like you to be the new, okay, take Rumsfeld's place. Gates says, oh, does that mean I could be Secretary of Defense? Yeah, of course it does. Yeah, but don't worry about it. We got this Saint David Petraeus, who's going to do the military part. And we have Jack Keane, who four-star. He's going to do the Fox News sort of thing. We're going to have this surge, and we're going to prevail. It's going to be great, and I won't lose so bad in this election. And we get rid of Rumsfeld, we'll send him out in 3 times. Well, that's what happened. That's documented. Not many people know that. So what happened? Well, there was a surge into Baghdad, during which that terrible photography in July of 2007, collateral murder photography video that was shown on WikiLeaks, courtesy of Bradley Manning at the time. So that's the way it went. They threw these guys into this surge, 20,000 of them. How many American soldiers were killed? 950 is the best estimate. It's pretty accurate too. It comes from good figures. Okay, so 950 soldiers killed to save Bush's prospects in this election. Who did his bidding? Well, a Russophobe, a very malleable. We used to call him a windsock, a windsock, in as a head of the agency and all. One last footnote, and I just think this is very relevant for today. Now, I ended up by happenstance or providence to become one of the briefers of the president's daily brief. Now, that was a one-on-one exercise. I had known George H.W. Bush from when he was head of the CIA, worked directly under him for a while before I went overseas. So we became really good friends. And that's not to say I slanted any of my reporting to him. I told him like it was. And similarly, I gained the trust of George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State at the time. And, you know, I used to brief these people, plus the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the succession of national security advisors to the president, some of which ended up in jail. But I used to brief two or three of them every morning. So that was really lucky because I could do that. There was no one looking over my shoulder. I had been trusted by my immediate superiors based on my experience, my knowledge of Russia, and the fact that I would be honest and tell them like it is. Now, I have reason to believe they tried to get rid of me. Gates was by this time the head of analysis. But when they asked my immediate supervisor to get rid of McGovern, tell George H.W. Bush that McGovern's leaving, my immediate supervisor said, I'm not going to tell him that. You tell him that. You get George H.W. And tell you guys personally tell Shultz that and tell him why. Why? So I was able to stay there 4 years for the whole first thing of Reagan. Now, while I was doing that, I didn't really know that the exercise, the big nuclear war exercise that was planned, the name was Able Archer, okay? And that was planned for and conducted in November of 1983. Now, here's the setting. Reagan had called the Soviet Union Axis of Evil, or he said, you know, they're terrible people. And they had shot down KAL-007 with almost 200 passengers killed, okay? And they had been blamed for doing that deliberately, okay, at the UN, okay? And the Russians knew, the whole world knew, yes, they did it deliberately. But did they know it was a passenger plane? No. How do I know that? Well, I won't divulge any sources and methods here. All I can say is I read a book later, okay, by the name of the State Department supervisor for videos and all that kind of stuff. And he prepared the video that was shown at the UN to show that the Russians deliberately shut down a civilian aircraft. Well, the liberal part was right. Okay, this thing was way into Soviet airspace, and they wouldn't react to any of the warning signals. And so we had the communications saying, should I shoot it down? Follow your orders, shoot it down, okay? I can't figure out what it kind of plane is, shoot it down. Those were the orders. Now, the guy who prepared the tape to be shown learned only later that they only used the parts to show that they shot this plane down deliberately, right? It didn't show the part which said, well, we know what kind of plane this is, you know. They didn't know it was a civilian aircraft. My point is simply that the Russians knew that we knew that it was, that they didn't know about the civilian aircraft thing, okay? So that was around Labor Day weekend. So here we are going into November. Tensions are very high, and there's this aged autocracy in Russia, Chernenko and what's the other guy's name? Anyhow, they were sort of, you know, old and decrepit. NVIDIA comparisons are invidious, so I won't go any further than that. But when they saw this major exercise, which included the Vice President of the United States in the nuclear change of command, and maybe the rest of the White House too, they thought it was the real thing. Now, does that matter? Yeah, we're alive today because they were dissuaded that it was the real thing. How did that come about? We know from a spy that the British were running, his name was Gordievsky, okay? He was a KGB guy. He said, look, my superiors will think this is a real thing, for God's sake. Is it the real thing? I mean, I'm supposed to report it. Okay, so we know about that's going on in London. And we know from other things I won't mention, that the Russians are taking this as the real thing. So what happens? My good colleague, Mel Goodman, who worked in the same branch as Bobby Gates did when I was chief of the Soviet foreign policy branch, and knew Gates very well in those days, was two levels removed for him by the time Gates became head of all analysis. He goes to Bobby Gates with two of his friends and he says, "Bobby, they're taking us seriously. For God's sake, let's call that off." And Gates says, "Don't worry. They'll make the Russians happy. They don't have to worry about it." As he said in his book that I have here, making the Russians happy or feeling secure is not number one on my to-do list. So he's not even head of the CIA yet. He's just head of analysis in the CIA. So to their great credit, these courageous analysts go around Bobby Gates and they go directly to arch Russophobe Bill Casey, director of Central Intelligence at that time. Say, "Mr. Casey, we can't convince Bobby Gates of this, but we know that the Russians are taking this seriously. Would you please call the White House and get this thing called down, smoothed down, no White House participation, and reassure the Russians this is not the real thing?" And Casey said, you could never understand what Casey said. I think I was the only one in person that would say, "Pardon me, Mr. Casey, what was that?" my uppers would do. "No, you don't say that to me." Anyhow, so that's what he said. And then as they went out, Mel says, "Are you going to do something about it, Mr. Casey? We're talking about war."
"Yeah."
He called the White House, got it called off. Abel Archer. Read the story. Mel has written about this most recently in some of these blog things. What am I saying? I'm saying that Bobby Gates was a Russophobe. He was educated at Russophobia Central, Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. There was a person there that was director of Russian studies, Angela Stent. She became national intelligence officer right before or after, I can't remember which, Fiona Hill, okay? And that last report, Angela Stent was still disputing the notion that Secretary of State Baker ever promised to Gorbachev and Shevardnadze that the NATO would not move one inch to the east. I mean, defying all the evidence. So these guys make up things, okay? And that's what's happening now. They're making up things. And just to kind of conclude, when I was researching Russiagate, and when we, Robert Parry and I and others, Joe Lauria, who is now heading Consortium News, when we kept reporting that, look, Russiagate is a fraud. We can prove from technical evidence that there was no Russian hack of the DNC. Now, go back here and just realize that we said that on December 12th, 2016, for God's sake. Okay, we could already sell. We had two former technical directors of the National Security Agency, NSA, that does all this stuff. We also had that bevy of information that Ed Snowden brought into Hong Kong. We had his slides. We put the slides in the article, okay? That was December 12th, 2016, when President Trump was just president-elect. And we tried to explain, well, he was too weak to take on the people who did him in. And that's the danger now. And let me just finish with this. American people have been brainwashed, and I use that word advisedly. If Blinken or Sullivan, or if Biden says we have to send troops into Ukraine to save the day, we have to do more with respect to Ukraine, lest we lose. And the danger is for them that they'll lose before the election. I mean, they're already pretty much lost, but they they're hanging on here until the election, and it looks so far as though Putin's not going to push anything to the nth point until after the election. If we lose, it's going to be really a problem. And so the American people are prepared because they still believe, Jack Keane 2 days ago, other people chiming in, oh yeah, Russian hacking, Russian hacking, Russian hacking. They're going to do it again in 2024. For whom? Well, Putin said he prefers Joe Biden. Huh? Why did he say that? Because at least Biden is predictable, okay? So, you know, you're going to have to adduce lots more evidence to persuade me that the Russians wanted Trump in 2016 or that they want him now, you know? The worst thing a Russian leader has to fear is an unpredictable U.S. president. They'd rather have a sleepy one, you know? They'd rather have one that at least they can find is a little bit more predictable. So here's the deal. There's a lot of pressure on Putin now to move definitively in Ukraine. He has already said that, you know, we were moving pretty fast, faster than usual. Now we're doing a half again times faster after this Kursk thing. And not only that, young Russian men are filling our recruitment stations as they never have before. And I think this is true, he didn't say this, but the Russian people, you know, they have some experience with war. They have some experience with invasions. They have some experience with Russian, with the German tanks coming down on Russian servicemen and killing civilians in the process. So what I expect in Ukraine is that the Russians are going to surround what's left of the what I expect in Kursk is that the Russians will surround these Ukrainian forces and do them all in and then proceed forward in the Donbass. Now, that's going to happen the next several weeks. And so the question is, what will Biden do? And if, you know, it's hard to even fathom that he would go as far as he already has, given all the red lines that he has already crossed. But let's say these F-16 aircraft. Now, they are said to have been delivered to Ukraine. I don't know where they are. But the question to me is, if they're armed or even suspected to be armed with these long-range standoff missiles that the U.S. has also promised to provide now, they're going to be shot down as soon as they leave the airfield. Or, if I were a conservative Russian Air Force general, I would tell Putin, no, we know they're on that airfield in Moldova. We had to destroy that airfield. Putin, won't that escalate things? Well, not so much. Moldova is not part of NATO, okay? Well, how about if they're in Romania? Well, from a military point of view, Mr. Putin, we ought to hit those airfields with the F-16s on them before they get up in the air. Why? Well, as you yourself have said, Mr. Putin, they're nuclear capable. They can carry nuclear weapons into their wings. And if they get these standoff missiles that the U.S. has just promised, then they can fly up in the air and hit way into Russia in a standoff way where we can't shoot them down without our aircraft going there, and it's too late. Oh, okay. Well, tell me more as soon as you think they're about to fly out of Romania or Poland or Moldova. So now to prevent that, what would these people do, these military advisors of Putin? Well, look at their record. A year and 1 month ago, they told Biden to say in Helsinki in a major speech, haha, Putin has already lost this war. And his head of the CIA supplemented that by saying, you know, the ineptitude of the Russian army has been laid bare for the world to see, right? Okay. Now, why haven't they been fired? why hasn't their nominal boss, Averill Haynes, the director of national intelligence, why hasn't she been fired? Because she told Biden, told everyone publicly in January of that same year, last year, that the Russians were running out of ammunition and that they had no indigenous capability to replace the ammunition that they were losing on the battlefield. That's what she publicly told everyone, including Biden, I assume. So why is she still around? Well, she still is. So the only thing I would say that I would agree in a measure with Donald Trump is when he accused, during that debate, he accused Biden, well, you know, fire anybody, you know, fire. These guys should be fired. So this one winded way of saying, look, if these same guys are making these decisions, if he goes to Austin, who in my view is a cipher, I mean, the only hope I have is the Joint Chiefs of Staff who have some real experience in these matters and some more brains, okay? If he goes to Austin and says, well, you know, what would we do? Well, you know, we have a choice. We could send some troops in there, and that will give the Russians, because they don't want to get involved in war with us. Or, you know, we have these low-yield nuclear weapons. They're right on the shelf there. You have the key, Mr. President. They would show the Russians, and, you know, if they were used, like, just as a warning before the election, we might not lose so badly or so definitively in Ukraine. We won't lose the election, and then your son Hunter and you and Blinken and Sullivan, all of whom Trump has the book on, okay, yeah, will escape the inevitable consequences of having done to Trump what you did for those 4 years. So all I'm saying is that, do I think it's possible that these military advisors would give him that kind of counsel? I do, and that scares the hell out of me, okay? I mean, there are personal stakes in here, personal freedom, for God's sake. These guys could go to jail. They have the book on them, okay? So what will Biden do? I don't know. Whether he's compos mentis. What will Blinken and Sullivan do? I think I know what they will do. The question is what the Joint Chiefs of Staff will do. Will they acquiesce? Will they say, oh, okay, we always take orders, even though the orders that they've taken from these people who are Russophobes don't make a lot of sense in terms of the wider picture. So that's the deal here. I talked a lot about Russophobia. I'll just end up by saying another word about China, or Sinophobia, okay, Chinophobia, if you will. When Richard Nixon was president, I had lots of problems with all the things he did, not all of them, but some of the things he did in domestic affairs, but he was really smart. He was a smart guy, Henry Kissinger. Think what you will of him. War criminal, probably, but at least he knew which end was up, right? And he knew how to play the Chinese off against the Soviets. And what they wanted to do was make it possible to exploit the very real rift between Moscow and Beijing. And so they went to Beijing. And who went with them? Chaz Freeman, whom you've had on your program here. Now, Chaz is well known in Washington, about the smartest guy ever, okay? When he needed to learn Chinese, you know, it takes people usually about 2-3 years. Well, there are stories of him after 7 months doodling and doing crossword puzzles as the others. He learned Mandarin like that, okay? So he's the interpreter for Nixon. Not only that, but they worked out this deal, okay? One China. And that created, 30 years of stability, okay? Until Nancy Pelosi and these other people decided to play around with China and make sure that China is not going to be the major power in the world. All right, that's us. So what I'm saying here is that Chaz Freeman is kind of the exception because he's so exceptional. I mean, he didn't take Chinese area studies. He learned about China in 2 years rather than just better than 3 or 4 years, okay, academically. And he knew about Russia too. He knew about the Middle East. He knew about our Defense Department. He was ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He brought the kind of expertise in a wide sense, concentrated on China, but in the Middle East as well, to the table. And so what happens? Well, we've talked before about the shining example of how the intelligence community can make a real contribution to peace. And that was November 2007, when the National Intelligence Estimate, the supreme genre of intelligence analysis, decided unanimously and with high confidence that Iran was not working on a nuclear weapon. And there was no evidence that they would change that policy anytime soon. 2007, okay. What's this, 2024? Same judgment every year, including this past March. Now, who is responsible for that? I said before, Tom Finger, guy from State Department, okay? Now, after Tom Finger played a huge role, and his people, of course, in preventing a war against Iran on Bush and Cheney's way out, you know, riding into the sunset, after he did that, he hung around in hopes that somebody like him would be appointed director of the National Intelligence Council, okay? And I don't know if he prayed, but he must have really hoped and prayed. And all of a sudden, Dennis Blair, who was the honcho, he was the director of national intelligence, he's an admiral. He knew which end was up, and he knew Chess Freeman from previous incarnations, right? And he said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to appoint Chess Freeman to be head, to be director of the National Intelligence Council. And Tom Finger said, thank God, my legacy will be preserved. You got another honest guy, not only honest, but he knows which end is up. Okay. So way to go there, Dennis, way to go. So Dennis announces that Chaz Freeman is going to be head of director of the National Intelligence Council. Now, this is a big job. It's a very most one of the most important jobs in Washington, but it's a downgrade. I mean, Chaz was an ambassador. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, you know. So this is a step down. It doesn't even require Senate confirmation. It's at the pleasure of the Director of National Intelligence. He saw the woodwork on the wall, the writing on the wall, okay? And he said, okay, we have Chaz in here. He'll put a measure of sensibility in here. Guess what happened? On March 10th, Chaz Freeman took his duties as director of the National Intelligence Council, a demotion, really, but he took it on because he saw what Tom Finger was able to do and what he wanted to be able to do. And he lasted in office for 6 or 7 hours until the Israel lobby got to President Obama and said, we can't have this guy. Look what he's saying about the Palestinians. He said the Palestinians have a right to exist. And he's saying all these crazy things. You gotta get rid of this guy. So there was a big brouhaha even before March 10th, 2009. And it was questionable as to what Dennis Blair would do. And we wrote him, the veteran intelligence professionals for Sandy, wrote him a memo. We prepared it on the 8th and 9th of March. We published on the 10th, and it only had relevance for 3 hours or so before Freeman was canned. Now, when I say Freeman was canned, Chaz, you know, always puts the country first. He saw that he couldn't really function if the Israel lobby was continually picking at him. That whatever he did, however objective, they would be, and Obama would cave. And did Obama cave in this instance? Yes, Obama caved. He called up Blair and said, sorry, Dennis, this guy looks like a good guy on paper, but I'm getting a lot of flack about him. You better tell him he's got to go. And Chaz dutifully, for the good of the National Intelligence Council, wrote a resignation letter. Now, that's a telling story, I think, about how politics has intervened in intelligence. Because as I said, this position did not even require Senate confirmation. And you have the warm arm of AIPAC, the Israel lobby, reaching in and telling the President of the United States, no, he can't get objective intelligence anymore. Tom Finger is gone, and this guy is just as bad as Finger. Because Finger said we couldn't have a war on Finger said Iran's not working on a nuclear weapon. Well, Bush himself said that deprived me of the option to have a war against Iran before we leave office. And so we don't want another guy like that. So expertise, yeah. The kind of expertise that uniquely Chess Freeman had in these various areas, but expertise nonetheless, which he was so talented and able to bring to bear on these issues, including Chinese, Mandarin, and several other languages that he speaks fluently. Well, he's probably the archetype of people that we needed intelligence. Instead of these flecks, I guess I mentioned to you that I debated this fellow Duss on Amy Goodman. You can look that up. That shows you the kind of people that people like even Bernie Sanders and other people in Democrat National Committee rely on for information. See what he says about Ukraine. See what I say about Ukraine. And see if I wasn't correct in singing that song, "You've Got to Be Perpetually Taught to Hate and Fear." Sorry to carry up so long here, but that's about it.
It was amazing, Ray, providing us with this important information and how you just mentioned every detail on what's going on. Thank you so much, Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
You're most welcome. Take care, Nima.